You are a toy! You weren't the real Buzz Lightyear, you're an action figure! You are a child's plaything!
You are a sad, strange little man.
Welcome to Percolated Media's Toy Story Retrospective Series.
Shall we play a game?
No, thank you.
Are you sure?
Join Matt.
Oh, thank goodness you're here!
Adam.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Huh? He's posing.
And Garrett.
Stand still, Godzilla!
As they look at each film of the Toy Story franchise.
Alright, let's review this one more time.
From 1995's beloved original,
let's go home and play.
To 2022's Lightyear and beyond,
shoots and ladders.
Andy's favorite podcasters will review each Toy Story film and decide individually if the series flies or just falls with style.
Son of a building block!
So get ready to reach for the sky, podcast listeners.
Hello? Check. That better? Great. Everybody hear me?
Percolated Media's Toy Story Retrospective begins now.
All right, let's go.
Lightyear. Released June 17th, 2022. Budget was $200 million. Box office take, $226 million. Ouch. And this was directed by Angus MacLean. Apparently, this movie proved that the Toy Story brand wasn't an automatic license to print money, because for the first time in this retrospective, we have a Toy Story adjacent movie, in quotes, that did not do well at the box office. And Adam, you mentioned this last time that you didn't see this, but you kind of heard from osmosis. Why do you think this did not do well?
I think there was a couple reasons, and I thought about this while we went into it. I mean, one, the time frame, you know, it was post, I mean, we were coming back to theaters and we all wanted to see movies. You had some that really blew up at this time, but it was, for the most part, I really think their messaging got confused on what kind of movie it was. And I think this movie is about 10 years too late. And that's, save this for wrap up discussion at the end of this all. You put this thing out after Toy Story 2, I think you have a completely different scenario.
Adam kind of took my answer in that I think it was the timing as well. I don't think anybody was aching to see a backstory of Lightyear or what this ends up being, which is kind of a backstory, kind of not. It just fell on deaf ears for a lot of people.
And I know Garrett doesn't know this for the most part. Matt probably does with, you know, being the family man that he is, but we had Buzz adjacent stories that they were, you know, Buzz Lightyear and Star Command. And so his adventures in space were known to the kids that would have cared about this. So 27 years after Toy Story, this seems like a made for, you know, the wonderful world of Disney on ABC Sunday night.
Oh, wow. You brought that out of the hat, huh? Holy shit.
Well, for me, this, and you guys touched on some of the points that I want to delve into deeper with the actual movie, because I think there were things that were going against it, and we were still, to Adam's point, at the time where not everybody felt comfortable going back to theaters unless you had Spider-Man in it, apparently, because that thing came out in December of 21 and was like the third highest grossing movie of all time. This did not do anywhere near those numbers, and I think a lot of it has to do with Pixar's messaging and the marketing in general. To Adam's point, his first one, the idea of doing stories with Buzz Lightyear independent of the toys themselves had been done before and pretty successfully. They did a direct-to-video movie in 2000, right after Toy Story 2. They got Tim Allen to do the voice, which is ironic given this movie that we're going to talk about, that served as the pilot for a TV show that was on the Disney Channel, and that ran 62 episodes, which is a pretty solid run for most animated shows at that time. But in that, they had Patrick Warburton doing the voice at the time, where he was one of the big people to get to do voiceover work. And Disney must hate that show, because you can't find it anywhere.
No, you really can't.
They froze it in carbonite and sent it out into space because it's darn near impossible to find. It's not on Disney Plus, and it had enough of a fan base at the time and did well enough to where it inspired a ride at Disney and is completely independent of this movie, which took 5.5 years from the start of development to release date. And my God, it kind of shows. Because this got announced, to get into the backstory a little bit, and why I think this kind of crippled itself getting out of the starting gate, was right after Finding Dory released, which to me felt like a sequel they only made because people were asking for it, and I remember next to nothing about it. So that rationale being adjacent to doing a Buzz Lightyear spinoff gave me pause for concern right away.
Yeah, and I feel the same. Between Finding Dory, Monsters University, Pixar had turned into the Walt Disney direct-to-video sequels all of a sudden. And I'm still, to this day, disappointed in Pixar for what they've become. And I think it dramatically shows in how people feel about that studio. I mean, they were the standard bearer, and I don't think they're even close to the top anymore. And a lot of it has to do with those decisions.
Yeah, Pixar was the standard bearer. And one thing you can say about Pixar, we talked about it when we did the previous Toy Stories, is they had a real quality control that met a standard unlike anything else. DreamWorks came out with their Shrek movies and everything else, but there wasn't really much that they did that really had a lasting impact. And the thing about Pixar is their stuff, people still, Adam showed his kids, Matt, I know you're showing your kids, and that quality seemed to disappear. And I want to say something that is probably going to be controversial.
Why stop now?
I think a lot of that has to do with them offloading John Lasseter. I think once they had him step down, that quality control disappeared. And I think it's showing in the output that they've come out with. Now, there's parts of this movie. Look, I'm not going to completely deride this movie to preview that. I think there are things that I do like about it. But I think the quality control went away when John Lasseter went away.
I think it had more to do, for me, with Disney being the controlling force versus someone departing. Because around this time also, they finally announced Incredibles 2. We had a third Cars movie that was coming out. And I found it just odd because while Incredibles 2 and Finding Dory were tremendous financial successes and got good reviews, I don't think they had the impact as films that their predecessors did. And it was odd because Pixar's some of their best work was around this time. Inside Out, Coco, purely original movies. And before all you people start saying, oh my God, they just ripped off Herman's head, I'm going to bitch slap you when you talk about Inside Out. But that notwithstanding, we got Toy Story 4. And around that time was when Tim Allen was talking about, yeah, they're probably going to do a spinoff film. And I'm game to do it. But that, as we'll talk about, did not wind up coming. He didn't show up to the recording booth. And they said, so this is where it gets really muddled. The director was hired, who ironically worked on the opening sequence for the Starkman show. Mm-hmm. He directed the CGI opening. And he started talking about this being a live-action film within the Toy Story universe. Like, basically a film within a film. Whereas the Starkman show was just based on the movies, and they were based on, the toys were based on the TV show. And I think that messaging confused a lot of general audiences as to what the hell this movie actually was.
Yes. And look, this was going to be one of my first notes. There's an easy way to fix this, and they don't do it. You have a trailer, or you start this movie with, we know Andy, we know the characters. If you want to start off, this is Andy's favorite movie. Great. Have Andy do what we would have done. Have him get his toys together, sitting with him, and show him putting in a movie, and then start this film. You could do that in a trailer. And you could understand what this is. But I didn't really understand it until I sat down to watch it. And yeah, I blame so many decisions. We'll discuss whether this is good and bad. But the trying to sell this to the public when you spent $200 million on it and probably another $70 to $100 million in marketing, you can't screw this up that badly. But they did.
And you also could have done, before we get into the movie, like, the, to Adam's point, I was thinking you have a grown-up Andy with kids of his own showing his kids what he watched as a kid.
Yeah,
show them the same way that, yeah, like, our, that, you
what,
know.
It's what we do.
Right. You know, it's here, us saying, hey, our nostalgic stuff is good, and we're going to force you to watch it.
Damn it, kids, you will love Raiders of the Lost Ark. Come here.
Now, this director had done a ton of Pixar shorts, but how did he actually get this gig?
My guess is, and this is purely speculation on my part, was because he worked on the show and was the only one enthusiastic about doing this project.
Probably. I think,
and Disney just said, all right, we'll greenlight it because Toy Story was their cash cow in every instance. And then they announced Chris Evans was going to do the voice of Buzz Lightyear. And I said to myself, that's odd, but
yeah.
Did they just wake him up off a couch after he was done as Captain America? Like he went into his dressing room, took off the suit for the last time, and they said, hey, while you're here, we have a new job for you. Because this, to me, was antithetical to what Pixar had done for so long, where they didn't feel the need to get movie stars to lead these big movies, especially for a character like Buzz Lightyear. I think it was a very odd casting choice. Not that I hated it, I just didn't see the logic in doing it.
Yeah, I didn't see the connection either. And the three of us have talked about it with almost every Pixar movie we've done, in that Pixar had an interesting way of casting people where they cast voices not based on stardom, but based on how they fit the character. And this was the first time, I completely agree with you, Matt, since the first Toy Story, which they had to get those names to get the movie that they got, where I felt they were trying to cash in on a name instead of actually casting the character. Or Tim Allen said no, and Chris Evans was the first one they called. It's muddled, but I felt the same way, where I scratched my head too when I saw that Chris Evans had done this voice. Even as late as last week, I thought Tim Allen had come back to do this voice. And then you guys corrected me and said, no, he hadn't. So, curious choice for sure.
I think if you do this live action, I could kind of understand it. Maybe somebody kept that in there. But when you start putting your voice talent top line above the character, that's not been what Pixar's about. That's been what some of the other studios, to their detriment, have been about. Look at DreamWorks Epic. Ugh, Epic fail.
Oh, my God.
Fucking Beyonce should never. Okay. sorry, I'm bitter still. It is, to both of your point, it is antithetical to what they've always been, and this just seems to be it seems to be the Disneyfication of Pixar, and you can put that in a lot of buckets for a lot of IPs, but the messaging might be never so strong as it is with this one.
They apparently never considered Tim Allen. There was a quote from the producer saying, Tim is the embodiment of the toy Buzz, and this isn't the toy world, so it doesn't make sense. There's not a role. It would cause more confusion for audiences instead of helping them understand the movie we're trying to tell. If they were trying to make a movie that audiences could understand, they failed based on the opening of this movie. And the box office numbers are proof for that. Especially when you're thinking about tying this to Toy Story. All the Buzz toys sound like Tim Allen. You know, it's not hiring the comedian Tim Allen to do a voice. Like, he voices the character Buzz Lightyear. So why you're having someone else do it, unless this is supposed to be, and this is me getting a little deep into the weeds, if this is supposed to be like Andy in his universe watching a live-action Buzz Lightyear movie. That's the only excuse I can think of.
Yeah, right away, when they show that title at the very beginning, you know, I had this in my notes for when we get into the movie, but I'll say it now. Right away, they're asking you to get into the head of a five-year-old child. Saying, look, this was Andy's favorite movie. And I think right away, that's a mistake. It's just the wrong approach. And I'll get into the themes when we start getting in. But right away, I knew that there wasn't going to be the set of themes, the adult themes that we have talked about. These movies, each and every one of them has had an impact on at least one of us to the point where we are wet with tears. When you say that at the beginning of this, and we get introduced to the characters, right away, you know that's not coming. And so that really threw me for a loop when I saw that at the beginning of this film.
Well, speaking of being thrown for a loop, I think one of the reasons why this movie also did not do well were the trailers sucked.
Yeah.
They were really uninspired. They did nothing to distinguish like why you're bringing this IP back beyond just trying to get some nickel and dimes. And it kind of blew up in their face. And in the same way that when I saw Forky in Toy Story 4, when I saw that goddamn cat in the trailers, I cringed because I thought it was... Now, we'll talk about if they proved me wrong, but I had that same knee-jerk reaction to Socks that I did with Forky, where I said they're just out of ideas.
Yeah. It's look, it to me, it felt like so many of their direct-to-video sequels. Like, why would I go see this in a movie theater? You have Disney Plus at this point. You're making content directly for that. And that's kind of what this felt like, especially knowing that that's what Toy Story 2 was supposed to be, you know, a direct-to-video sequel. This felt like a, here, watch it on Disney Plus, direct-to-video type of situation. Nothing screamed, go see this on a big screen with the marketing. I say that... They've had, man, I don't know who's in charge of their trailers and marketing recently, but you got a new CEO. It's time to dig deep and do some work, brother.
Well, in their defense, I don't know if there's a way you can market this movie. I don't think there's a way you could say, okay, in relation to the Toy Story universe, I mean, how do you market?
Nostalgia. You do it with nostalgia. You market it to the person who saw this at 10 years old, who is now 40. And you're just like, you know, do you remember your favorite movie? And you show Andy putting in that VHS and sitting down with his kids. Like, I think you explain it that way, because the thing with Pixar, if you don't get parents to bring their kids aren't going to see this like it's freaking, I don't know, whatever little animated movie that's out on the weekend. Pixar has always been, because they're massive budgets, you have to earn $800 million to do it. And they usually do by appealing to full four quadrants. And I can't say this movie doesn't, but the marketing doesn't.
No. And they try to appeal to all the quadrants, right down to some ways to get brownie points for certain advocacy groups, which I have issues with when we get into the movie, but not for those reasons. So stay tuned.
But of course, that was, again, part of the, as soon as some of those details leaked out, the campaigns to boycott this movie were in full force, and they didn't have the effect of having the opposite effect like they normally do. This movie was trash talk because, heaven forbid, we show reality, you know, current reality in an animated film. But we'll get there.
That went right over my head. I had no idea about that controversy until I saw scene, and then I started digging in a little bit, and I'm like, oh, shit. It was like a 2.5, 2 second fucking shot, and man, was there fucking...
Well, discourse. It happened with Rise of Skywalker. It was the same thing. That's true, too.
Yeah.
But this, like, also, all the genres to bitch about it, science fiction is not the... I mean, look, this shouldn't be controversial anymore in modern society. That's what bothers me on principle. But it's science fiction, which is supposed to be the idealistic future, uh-huh, where it's not based in reality, so this should not bother fucking anybody. I'm so tired of this being a thing.
When you open up the second biggest... market to your films being a foreign country, and the government of that country has its own censorship board, you now put yourself at risk for them to make decisions on how you edit that, your movies. And Disney specifically has capitulated their editorial decisions to the Chinese censor board. They've done it now for what, since like phase two of Marvel, because they thought, as long as we can appease to it, we earn an extra $400 million, and this is the result.
And Matt, I'm completely with you, where I cannot wait until we get to a point where Captain Kirk sleeping with a green chick is as different as we can go. When when what happens in this movie becomes the norm, that's going to be a better society, in my opinion.
Green women, okay. Two women, no.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and to the surprise of everyone, this thing tanked so hard it might as well be playing in the NBA. Because holy crap, this, I mean, when the fact that you're on Disney Plus, not even 2 weeks after it comes out, and if you went to every Target or Walmart and saw all the merchandising on the shelves, it was clear that this did not have any real resonance with its Target audience, either Target audience for that matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was to the point where, and we talked about this last week, but Matt and I, we were going to review it and tie it into our previous Toy Story retrospective, but we weren't really making a huge push. We were like, you know what? There's Superman out there. There's Batman out there. We have other things we need to do. Let's kind of put this on the shelf until a new Toy Story comes out, which it's never going to happen. Oh, wait, it is. So that's the only reason we finally got to review it. But yeah, I watched this on a plane on the way to Florida, which probably isn't the most ideal way to watch a movie. But yeah, I watched this on the plane, and then I had realized, and this probably says something about the movie, but a week later, I had almost completely forgotten the entire thing. So I rewatched it again last night to prepare for this.
Yeah, watch it at home. Disney Plus, good screen, good quality. It obviously wasn't a theater watch. If it wasn't for this, I don't think I ever would have bothered to get around to watching it. But this was popping on my big screen at home, and... see what, if it could take me to infinity and beyond.
And Matt, you saw this in theaters, right?
Yeah, I saw it, and it was like a freaking like a ghost town in there.
like where me and Jen went yesterday.
Yeah, like it looked like I was the sole survivor of the Nostromo walking around that theater.
And this was like honestly, a Saturday night, right? You go on those weekend nights.
No, I went Saturday morning afternoon.
Just, oh, okay.
From what I remember, because I don't 100% remember the details. I don't even think, was Riker even with me? No, I don't think so. I think I went by myself just because I wanted to check it out before it, you know, someone snapped their fingers and left theaters, because I wasn't paying for Disney Plus at the time because I got burned on all those fucking Marvel and Star Wars shows.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'm done. But then once in a while, they'll reek me back in. But I'm at the point now where it's like I'll buy a subscription when there's stuff on there that interests me, and then I cancel when I've had my fill. Speaking of having my fill, let's get into the movie. We open with a Star Wars-esque homage, a title crawl, so to speak. But when it's a crawl, it's more like a half a step, because the line is, in 1995, a boy named Andy got a Buzz Lightyear toy for his birthday. It was from his favorite movie. This is that movie. And right away, I have issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talked about how this was kind of wrong conceptually and how to get around it. But my problem is, so they timestamp it, right? 1995, we're given a specific time. This movie never feels like a 90s science fiction movie in any capacity.
Yeah. See, that's just it. We have to time it so that it looks like we're pre-1995, right? And you're absolutely right. There's nothing here that tells me this is pre-2022, you know? And to preview my thoughts on this, I think, once again, this seems like to be the broken record of all these podcasts, but this movie is fucking beautiful. They put the money in. There is not a dollar wasted on this production. But in watching it, I was thinking the same thing, like, okay, so this is what a 90s kid was watching? No, this is not what a 90s kid was watching.
No, I grew up in the 90s. This is not the kind of stuff I was watching.
Yeah.
And I don't like that, not to spoil this, I don't like that the one science fiction movie from the 90s that this director was inspired by was Lost in Space.
Oh, is that what he said?
No, I'm making that as a joke based on what the villain plot
gotcha.
We get.
Gotcha.
Are we not going to do that Joey massive hit one day?
No.
That Matt LeBlanc starring vehicle? No.
What we do open with is we see a Star Command exploration vessel with a bunch of people hypersleeping and Garrett. I noticed a lot of Star Trek references in this movie, which is kind of obvious given this director claims to be a big science fiction fan. Did you catch this kind of reminded me of the Botany Bay from Star Trek 2, where they're all in hypersleep?
Well, and me being the alien guy, too, it reminded me of Alien as well.
Yeah, especially like Covenant, where they're all like uh-huh. trying to plan it.
Yeah, I got those vibes.
Yeah. And even Takani Prime, that sounds like a world they'd visit on Star Trek.
Yes.
And he's awakened from hypersleep by the ship's AI, and we're introduced to this version of Buzz Lightyear, voiced by Captain America himself, Chris Evans. And this is going to sound like a backhanded compliment. I miss Tim Allen. And I never thought I would say that. It's not that Chris Evans is terrible. I think he reads his lines well, but he's not a voice actor. And there is a clear distinction when you get someone like, you know, Brad Pitt had this problem when he did Sinbad, that they can read their lines, but they can't infuse it enough into the animation to make it stand out. And he's hampered also by basically doing a Tim Allen impression, which leads you to ask the question, why didn't you just get Tim Allen in the first place if you're going to hire someone to pretend to be him?
Yeah, the association I have turned into a disassociation, because I'm the exact same way. I just did not envision this as the same character that Andy had a doll of in 1995. I think Evans is trying. I really do. I just didn't have any sort of connection to the character. And that's a problem when it's named after that character.
It bugs me a little bit only here in the beginning. I get over it, but to your point, yeah, Evans isn't, you could tell he's not used, ADR, yeah, obviously he does that with every big picture he does, but vocal acting for, and it's a completely different skill set, and we need to stop throwing actors because they're a name into it. They can't produce the same way. Jesus, just get Nolan North for everything already, or Troy Baker.
But the problem also is, so this movie, because it's a quote-unquote origin story, there's a lot of references to the original Toy Story movie. Like, he's giving direct lines about, like, the no sign of intelligent life they're using. Get into this right now. I hate how this movie this is kind of Disney groupthink on my part. This has sort of the MCU problem to a certain degree of they pick a joke and they just run it into the ground. And they do that with the mission logs.
Yeah.
Where they took a defining aspect of his character and just make it a joke. And it's antithetical also because he is a space ranger and the hallmark of like Star Trek are the captain logs. And you're making fun of that, but you're also not doing it in a clever manner. It's funny the first time when she's like, you know, no one ever listens to those, right? And I'm like, okay, that would kind of make sense because he's not a captain. But also, like, he does it later on when he doesn't have the apparatus. So you're just making him look stupid. This movie is clearly trying to say he's not a moron, but they still do those stupid jokes. A lot of humor in this reminds me of the worst of Marvel.
It irritated me at the beginning until she calls it out, and then I laugh, and I'm like, okay, that, you know what? That's a good one. The problem is they keep doing it throughout the entire movie. You need to drop it and then bring it back for the end as a callback to it and then have it matter. But that it's just nonstop throughout the movie, it loses its effectiveness.
Now, isn't Andrew Stanton a screenwriter of this?
Well,
or is he a producer?
No, he's not. He had a story credit, I believe.
Oh, he had a story credit. Okay. So he
so did everybody at Pixar.
Yeah, he did it. He did one of the 20 drafts that this movie base probably had. Yeah, you would think that quality control would be there. The only reason I made the association with the Captain Logs is because I've been going through the Star Trek cinematic movies lately. Been going through all of them. And I would not have made that association if I had not been going through those. So that's the only reason I knew where this came from.
But they land on this planet that they're looking to check out. It's him as commanding officer and a rookie, which is basically their homage to Red Shirts. They got Bill Hader to do this one voice. But they paid him for this and didn't pay him for Inside Out 2. I don't understand that. They get grabbed by a bunch of tentacles. And Garrett, I'm with you to a degree. I think the animation is good. But I hate the muted color palette that a lot of this movie has.
You're fucking colorblind. How did you see that?
Because I can tell that I can tell that the brightness is off, and I can tell that everything just looks really dark.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I made that association as well. I noticed the way everything is so dark. You know, that's what kind of made those Toy Story movies stick out so much. Is we were in a lot of brightness there, and it made it feel happy. This does not feel happy. This is in a lot of dark light. And yeah, I do agree with you. Although I don't see a flaw in it technically, I see a flaw in it story wise.
I'm seeing it as a contrast based on the stuff that they are focusing on. I can't say I minded it. I do think it's inconsistent because when this movie looks good, it looks amazing. Like it looks at some of the absolute heights of animation's possibilities. And then sometimes it looks like this should have been rushed to Disney Plus and seen on a small screen. But we get here into these vines, as you were saying, and they pull out these weapons. Did they just use the same animatic for Predator Badlands? We got the same weapons with a different color. We got the same I saw this movie and I saw it with the Yucha.
Now, canonically, if I'm comparing this to Toy Story, it also begs the problem. None of the Buzz Lightyear toys ever came with the lightsaber that they use. Like, to me, that if I was a kid, that's a lot cooler than the little laser he has on his wrist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I seldom use this.
I like that we at least saw those in action. You know, that's one thing I will give this movie and that I did make a note of is we do see all the things that Andy liked about the character in action, even if it's for a short time. But yeah, those little lightsaber things, yeah, it put me in mind of like when you go to a movie and you see the ushers walking down the aisle, they have those little things, those little wands. That's right. All I thought.
Yeah, like you used to land a plane.
Yeah. That's what I thought of when I saw those.
Well, they had to use that to direct people to go into the theater, and apparently people steered clear. But the poison ivy attacks them, and they have to retreat to the vessel because the planet has hostile life on it. They attempt to leave. And in the midst of trying to escape, Buzz accidentally damages the ship. So they wind up stranded through his own, I don't want to call it hubris, because he's not doing it to be like exceedingly arrogant. He makes a big mistake that he has to rectify throughout the course of the movie. But I thought them being marooned on this planet was an interesting way to set up the movie. I was kind of surprised that this was the avenue they were going down.
I did too. I didn't know what this movie was going to be, like plot-wise and story-wise. I had no clue. And I'm surprised by what it gives me. I didn't know what to expect, but I didn't expect what we got.
Now, Matt, Adam, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing?
We got a discussion to go through.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Stay tuned, listeners.
Yeah, because as we'll talk about, this movie has about five different plot lines that I feel like were grabbed by different scripts and they just merged them together. Mm-hmm. But as far as being the premise, because when they talk about like the Galactic Alliance, apparently it's only humans that exist in the Galactic Alliance, because you never see like any aliens that are part of this colony. It's just, I had that question, because when you talk about Star Trek, you know, the Federation's made up of all different types of races, and you know, for a sci-fi movie, a lot of this feels, it's got big ideas, but at the same time, it has the Star Wars problem of it does feel a little too small. But much like Star Trek IV with the Galaxium Crystal, they realize that they can't get home. That's literally Star Trek IV, they can't get home. And they
need some transparent aluminum.
You know, the only difference is there's no bills in this movie, but they realize that the fuel crystal needs to be redeveloped to power the ship home. And we cut to 1 year later, one of several literal time jumps we'll have in this opening third, which surprised me because I had no idea this was coming. They construct a colony, so they're kind of, you know, they're making do with what they have. They built civilization. It's basically Matt Damon's The Martian if it was an entire colony, but they're still trying to get home. And Buzz puts on his, I can't believe this came out the same year as Top Gun Maverick, because it's basically him trying to break the speed barrier in the opening of that movie in this movie.
Uh-huh. This, to me, when it cut to 1 year later, I'm flabbergasted. You know, I don't think Stevie Wonder didn't see that coming. But to me, this means that this was, much like Moana 2, this was a series. This was a 5 or 6 episode series that is cut together, because this is the stop point to jump to the next episode. And everything is structured in 22 to 25 minute jumps. Interesting. Not three straight acts. And that not necessarily negative, but I also don't know how this ship, the Turnip as they call it, and you know, it looks much like Close Encounters, you know, that type of ship. I don't know how you have the resources on that ship to build this colony. And it's not going to tell me. We just got to go with it. And I do.
So that point you just made is one of my problems that this movie sets up. All of the conflict is resolved either really haphazardly, out of convenience, or people discover stuff off screen and do all the hard work by chance. Like this, we cut to a year later. So all the struggles they apparently fixed, and we don't see that. And it also happens with the villain later on.
Mm-hmm.
So I have that problem where science fiction, what I like so much about Star Trek, is it's about smart people trying to resolve complicated problems. And this movie says, fuck that. But Buzz nevertheless gets in a test flight. They tell him it's going to take 4 minutes. And as he realizes through, you know, I think this animation is great when he's trying to go through the ring. I was thinking of Star Fox, where he's going through all the different rings. Yep.
Stunning.
The difference is there's no Slippy Toad making me want to throw my controller. But he comes back home and he realizes that this movie's a remake of Flay the Navigator.
Damn it. There goes that note.
It so is.
Because he comes back and it's time, you know, a big chunk of this movie is about time dilation, because what felt like 4 minutes to him was 4 years on the planet, because he doesn't realize that the guy grew a beard. And, you know, he comes back and he talks to his commanding officer about how she's got a wife or a girlfriend now. So I found this interesting that they were going down this route of time. And I thought that would cause him to not do it again. But as we'll find out, he does multiple test runs because he thinks he can do it. You know, it's like the Flash trying to run faster than the speed of light.
He can perfect it.
Yeah.
And look, like I said, I've been going through Star Trek, and sometimes when you go to these time jump plot lines, it can go awry. I'm going to say I like this plot of this movie. I like the connection he makes with Alicia. I like the fact that she's raising a son and it's with a wife, which, oh God, God forbid. But yeah, this is one of the only parts of the movie I really connected with, was this relationship.
I dug that again. It subverted what I thought, because obviously here it's a problem. You set up the conflict. You can't do this because of the time dilation. I need Paul Rubens explaining the time dilation to me.
Well, he's also Buzz is anything but compliant.
But to me, that means the only other time we're going to get this is at the end of the movie where he's got to do it again. So I can't believe that it actually is like, nope, we're going to do it a lot, and we are going to completely change the trajectory of how this is going to go by setting it. And I dig that. I wasn't expecting a montage. I wasn't expecting the way it did this and the passage of time. And then it got me. when we get to the point where, you know, he comes back one day and you start to see everybody else age up, and then what we get with Hawthorne, it hit me. It really did.
Yeah. To preview our next retrospective, there was a montage here.
Yeah, there is. And before that, he comes home and he realizes that she left him a little companion, and we're introduced to Sox the cat, which was an idea left over from a previous idea from a separate Toy Story movie or spinoff.
Much like Forky,
for something that I thought was going to annoy the hell out of me, he's my favorite character in the movie. I like that he's kind of a cross between Data from Star Trek and R2-D2.
Uh-huh.
And he's nowhere near as annoying as I thought he would be. So they got the guy who does it is one of the animators.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't get a celebrity voice for that. And I think he's pretty good. And I found this character to be nowhere near as annoying as I thought he would be, which, as we'll talk about, I can't say about the rest of the supporting cast.
No, we cannot. But yeah, I thought, because I watched the trailer before this to get into it, and I was like, oh man, they're going to make me hate a cat. So I'm a cat person, everybody. So I thought they were going to make me hate a cat. Yeah,
you got two on this, you and Garrett versus me.
Yeah.
but no, I dig Sox. I really do. I can't believe they reuse, you know, the Flurkin and Goose from Captain Marvel, but all the way down to the look. But it's, I dig it, and I think it's used right. And I think, to Matt's point, yeah, it's Data. It's a good job.
It's one of the only times where I think Pixar hits a note that they've hit before, and that every time you need a laugh, you kind of point to it. Sox the cat. This character worked for me as well. I really dug this character.
And by making it animatronic, a robot, you get rid of the problem of having a living feline.
Well, it's also the contrast of he never ages, but everyone else does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it gives him that kind of that eternal thing. And I'm glad they don't do the thing of, I thought this was going to be the trope, like, he has to go before the Galactic Council and talk about how Sox is a thing, it has feelings. I thought they were going to do Measure of Man from Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad they didn't do that, although I kind of wish they did, because to be honest, the plot of this movie is pretty straightforward, and I think that's a problem. Because there's, outside of a couple, like, emotional scenes, it's just a series. It's like Rise of Skywalker, which is just a series of contrivances to get to the end.
It is pretty simple. When you break it down, and for me, when I was breaking it down in these, what I thought was TV-sized chunks, it's simple, episodic, get here to here. We got to do this. Here's the problem. Okay, here's how we're going to solve it. Let's go. And that's what we do.
Yeah, and it's, I thought, like, the whole crux of the movie was going to be him trying to perfect the crystallization, because he uses Sox to try to, like, break the compounds down. See, that's what I like about science fiction. You have a problem, you're trying to fix it over and over. He keeps doing the time jump, but every time he does it, it's 4 years go by. His partner starts to get older and older. They do a funny gag where they keep showing her driving him to the test facility. And there's one where she's old and she's starting to steer and he has to pull the wheel back, which made me laugh. It's one of the only moments of subtle humor in the movie. Because another problem I have with this movie is that Pixar in general is very good about being like a four quadrant movie with their humor. Kids can find it funny and certainly very accessible. But if you're an adult, a lot of it will resonate with you as well. I think a lot of this movie feels too kidified, which is also odd given some of the places thematically they try to go. And I feel like they're trying to combat that by being too borderline childish with their humor.
But you are showing a movie that appealed to a five-year-old. And that's the mistake that you set up when you do that. Are you going to go too adult or are you going to go too kidified? And in my opinion, I don't think they kidify it enough to appeal to somebody who's 5 years old and falling in love with this character.
And that's what I think is their issue. I think when they do it, I think they're trying to remind us, hey, this is a kid's favorite movie. And it's just a problem with the structure they've set up.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with both of you in that way. Now, the flip side, 4 years old, my favorite movie was Return of the Jedi.
That explains so much. But the also thing is the humor does not feel like 90s humor. Now, I don't need them saying radical and all that type of stuff, but all the sensibilities and the trappings of this movie feel too they're too modern.
Mm-hmm.
They are, yeah.
And also, to get into this, you see the most controversial kiss outside of Triple H and Stephanie McMahon in 1999, where, you know, you see the lesbian couple kiss and people freaked out. But you guys lived through the 90s. You would never see this in a 90s kids movie.
You barely saw this in 90s TV.
You barely saw this in adult movies in the 90s. We had James Spader fucking a car before we saw two women scissoring in the 90s.
And every time it was shown, like on Ellen and those TV shows, there was uproar. So yeah, this would not go in a kid's film at all. And you're just trying to kill two birds with one stone with this. You're trying to say something, but at the same time, tell the story that took place in the 90s. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. I have nothing against this. I think I have made my stance on this clear on this podcast, but it just does not work in the context of this film.
Doesn't fit, but I don't care. I want it there. But I agree. 1995, animated, there's not a possibility. Ellen was front page news just for saying I'm gay on her show. Like, and it, she wasn't even out when, like, that was a part of the character, quote unquote. Right.
She kissed Laura Dern, and that was just like, oh my God.
No, I watched the show at the point. Like, it's so no, I agree. It doesn't fit for a 1995 movie. The flip side, I like the way that it's done because this just feels like it feels part of my life. So I want it there and I think it's important, but I don't disagree with you.
And also, it's not even 2 seconds. That's the crazy thing about this.
It wasn't in Rise of Skywalker either. Yeah. And that shit got almost banned from. That's the same country that cut a black man off the poster. So. That's true. Not to make it about one country, but I mean, when a company capitulates, this is what happens.
I just don't like putting it in just to get cheap brownie points. That's what I feel like so much of Disney's quote-unquote advocacy is box doing. Checking. Yeah, it's like we gotta do this to not lose our target audience and or at least a certain demographic. And, you know, I'm like, if you're going to be up in arms about it, then clearly you have much bigger issues than complaining about a kid's film. But eventually he goes back one last time, and by this point it's over 60 years and the colony is now developed, and he goes into her office and she left him a recording. And I gotta say, in a movie that I found very little emotional resonance in, this was the one gut punch I felt. Now granted, I saw this at a, not just because it's Chris Evans, I thought of when he goes to see Peggy in Winter Soldier.
Oh, damn. I didn't, and I should have.
Or it's like the ending of Interstellar. Like, it's nothing new, but I thought this was like the one thing that I kind of responded to on an emotional level.
Agreed. Yeah, and it's not new. I mean, any type of movie with this type of plot, this happens in it every time. I don't care because it works. And the way it does it, and the way that it pulls back to a wide shot, it's actually doing camera moves in an animated film, I think work really well. But yep, this hit me.
And she says, like, you know, I'm not going to be here any longer. My post is gone. And now there's a new commander, the new hotshot, who's basically shut down Buzz's repeated attempts to complete his plan. But Sox has been able to break down the compound to achieve faster than the speed of light. So what he has to do is Buzz has to use the new fuel to sneak into a ship. And they manage to succeed, although he commits basically treason by hijacking a federal ship, and he probably would be court-martialed when he comes back. But rather than jumping 4 years, he returns to a planet that has clearly seen better days. And as we'll find out, it's now 22 years later. And it's, I'll give it this, I guess Skynet won in this universe.
Skynet wins in every universe, my friend. Yeah, this was a... I guess I wasn't expecting it. I like this.
The whole dystopian future trope is certainly nothing new, nor is the idea of like artificial intelligence winning. But I like this as a setup for like what Buzz's hubris may have caught, like his hubris costing their defenses. But A, that's not where they go. And B, the movie doesn't wrestle or let you live in this type of world long enough for it to give you a response.
No, but there's a couple issues that I start to have here, issues in quotes. One, if they have all the technology for Buzz to keep doing these missions, build a simulator. You know, I mean, could kind of take care of some of this. But if you had kept growing your space city the way you had, why are we suddenly on a dystopian situation going on here? And I think I know why based on who shows up and everything else, but we learn they only showed up 2 weeks ago. So we did this to ourselves, and they never tell us why and what happens and why we're living this way.
Yeah, it took 2 weeks for them to undo 23 years of progress.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I think there's something.
Apparently, they were this planet's over Endor, and Zerg destroyed the shield generator.
I keep thinking there's going to be something with these vines that keep showing up. But no, that's just a tease for, as I said, Predator Badlands. I think they're going to be the answer at the end of this.
It's also very Star Wars-esque with the giant, like, Star Destroyer-looking ship just hovering over the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Buzz gets rescued by, as we'll find out, this is his partner's granddaughter, all grown up. She takes him to the colony's defense forces, or so he thinks. We're introduced to Mo and Darby. So we got convicts and a recruit. And I cannot stand Taika Waititi in this movie.
Thank you.
This is, to me, what Jar Jar Binks is to everybody else. Nothing he says is funny. They clearly just let him riff and gave no sense to pulling him back or doing another take. It's obnoxious with a capital O. And to me, this is the type of humor I can't stand, where it's just nonstop talking and eventually I will say something that's funny. It's like the worst instincts that Robin Williams had in his worst movies.
I'll disagree with you about this. I'm not going to say he's funny. What I'm going to say is I think this was written for him. I see this character being this way, and it's ill-advised. I agree with you. It's a terrible character.
It's Korg all over again.
Look, there's times where I like Taika Waititi, and I don't know, maybe 30% of the time. But this feels like he just set up a mic from his hotel room on the set of Thor Love and Thunder when he was so drugged up banging Valkyrie and Rita Ora that he didn't even have time to direct that film, and he just spoke some lines into a mic. It's distracting when he's there. It really is.
So Buzz thinks they're like actual Space Rangers. Turns out they're just recruits that have kind of taken up shop here to get away from the robot monsters. One of them grabs Buzz, and we find out that Mo is not a good shot. Nice little Hawkeye reference with him trying to use the bow and arrow to try to take him down.
That was funny.
Yeah, and you know, the action I think is okay, but I think this is a little too much slapstick for my liking.
Yeah, a little bit.
And Buzz is completely resistant to, like, all right, I'm going to pack up and you guys stay here. And speaking of jokes that go on too long, this thing with the droid trying to explain the route to go.
Ivan?
Yeah, Ivan, which I thought this was setting up in the way that the Pixar theory, I thought we were setting up this takes place in the same universe as WALL-E.
Especially because his ship looks like the By and Large ship.
Right. And I thought that Zurg was going to be, now I had no idea it was going to be what it turns out to be. I thought the Zurg mothership was going to be controlled by the Sigourney Weaver AI from WALL-E or something like that. There would be more like connective tissue, because WALL-E has, if you've never seen the movie, you know, robots are a big part of artificial intelligence. And so much of like the despondent world that we see is almost like what WALL-E lives on after we destroy the planet. And I thought that would have been a fun way to kind of tie things together, especially since you weren't going to tie it to Toy Story in any capacity beyond the opening crawl. And then we also get a scene where they have to sneak in and get past all the sleeping xenomorphs that are in there.
Yes.
To do the hyperspace. Like, again, my problem with the rest of this movie is that it's just, okay, we have to get the thing, rescue the thing to get back home. From here on out, there's not much in the way of like actively progressing a story with themes or characterization. It's just a series of hijinks.
Yep. That was never Pixar's strength, was doing these hijinks. Everything they did had purpose. And yeah, I'm with you. I don't think this has much of a purpose other than to show things go bang really well.
And it also gets weird. So they explain the suits. There's a surrender button.
Yes.
That never comes into play, which I thought that was a joke at Tim Allen's expense, because Galaxy Quest, the motto is never give up, never surrender. And the Space Rangers have a button that is designed to make you surrender. And then we got, you know, Schrodinger's pen, which I'd never find that joke funny, but they sure think it's the funniest thing on the planet.
Holy shit, that fucking pen.
Or the galaxy, for that matter.
Yeah.
That had to be somebody during the process who always said, you need a pen. That had to be somebody in the writer's room or storyboarding, and they just kept cracking themselves up fucking in Emeryville, so they worked it into the film.
So what they do is they go ahead, they sneak around the insect nest using the stealth buttons, and I hate in kids' movies where they don't know how to write jokes, so they just make everything really loud to try to mask that they don't have a lot of cleverness in their writing, because that's all this is. They're having to sprint full force to repair the ship, and they have to destroy the invading force at Zurg. It's basically the ending of Phantom Menace. They got to blow up the mothership to save the planet. And honestly, Taika Waititi to me is what everyone complains about Jake Lloyd being in Phantom Menace.
I feel like the movie is a little different once we get this crew. I'm like, all right, we get a different movie for the middle 30 minutes of this. It Like, it just takes a swerve. But I like the rest of the crew. You know, the old lady who can't, like, I love her. She's used just enough and minimal that she cracks me up every time she's making a joke. Hawthorne's daughter, I could see her trajectory, the entire plot of this. There's no surprises there whatsoever. But I dig the crew in very small doses.
See, I would have been fine because Pixar has mastered the buddy road trip if it was just Buzz and Sox. Like, I feel like everyone else is kind of superfluous.
Yeah.
Especially because they don't do anything beyond just convenient things. Like, even her big character moment when she, like, accidentally ejects part of the ship. She does that by accident.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they each do one thing wrong and one thing to redeem. It is a checkbox.
It's very simplistic writing where all the characters are defined by one trait and that's it. And they have to head back to the ship. There's a gag about sandwiches, which kind of did make me laugh about how the bread's in the middle and it's the meat at the top and the bottom.
Yeah, that made me
And they're
laugh
in a vending machine, which is the last thing I would want to eat out of a vending machine, especially one that's been there for God knows how long. Uh-huh. Buzz winds up getting captured by the Zurg ship. And conceptually, I like how Zurg looks. He's like, I was thinking of freaking Ironmonger from the first Iron Man. Where it's like a giant mech suit.
Oh, yeah.
Which, granted, is not how Zurg looked in Toy Story 2, but these movies don't care about canon, as we'll find out.
Yeah, I was waiting for Zurg, and when we finally get him,
You have to keep waiting, because he's not in this movie.
But doesn't Brolin play him, though?
Well, all right, well, let's get into that. Okay.
Before we do it, did you have any guesses of who it was going to be? Because they make it clear there's somebody in the suit. Did you have guesses of who it was?
I thought it was going to be his actual father.
Because of Toy Story 2.
And they make a joke about that because when he unmasks, he goes, father?
I thought it was going to be his partner that we are told died.
Oh, you thought it was going to be like the Wolverine?
Yep. I thought, you know, because you never see a bot. And then as I get to it, I'm like, would Pixar have the balls to do this? And they would do it in other Pixar movies, but I don't know if they would do it in this one. And I was like, it's going to be Hawthorne. At the end of the day, she does this because he kept failing.
See, I could have seen that. I also thought it could have been the Admiral, the new Admiral. Yeah.
And they
generic military villain.
I thought they tried to make that obvious it was him that I thought it wasn't.
Yeah, because there's really no one else, like, as far as established characters, it could have been.
No.
But he takes off the mask, and it's an older Buzz Lightyear, voiced by James Brolin. And my question was, why?
This was a bit of a what the fuck casting.
I mean, because I know that voice.
Yeah.
Like, right away, and I said to myself, it doesn't make sense that you would get a different voice actor, a third voice actor, to voice Buzz when his voice wouldn't change that much, unless they were going to say, like, he had severed vocal cords and had to talk robotically, like, get around that. But I found this odd, and as soon as they said it was an older Buzz, I said, oh, no. Because God knows I've seen this story a million times. Yep.
There's no guessing what's going to happen and who's going to do what at that point. The only thing that made me laugh is I kept thinking of Cap and Old Man Cap from the end of Endgame, you know, sitting on that bench. So,
well, someone should have said, hey, I think we should rewrite this movie. And they said, no, I don't think I will. Because, okay, this came out at a time, speaking of groupthink, where multiverses were super big in Marvel.
Yep.
And alternate timelines and all that bullshit. Because we find out this Buzz is from an alternate timeline where he went back, completed the hyperspace test. They tried to arrest him. He went back into space. And you talk about the convenience of all conveniences. He just finds all this technology. But it's not sophisticated enough because he can't go back far enough in time to where he wants to go. And that's why he needs the fuel that Buzz Prime has. Boy, I rebelled against this a lot. Like, from here on out, the movie, I wish they took a complete rewrite to this third act.
The funny part to me is they're explaining this is only a couple years removed, where I feel like I need the Sorcerer Supreme to explain alternate timelines and time travel. Because Disney now has decided like 3 or 4 different ways that time travel works. And I don't care that they're different franchises. It just made me laugh. And then based on this, what the ending of this movie and the decision they make means that this part should not be able to happen. So, paradox.
Yeah, because alternate timeline is not a strictly separate future. And I feel like they're conflating the two, because how can two Buzzes exist in the same timeline without canceling each other out?
Yeah, if these two can exist in the same timeline, then what they want to do at the end of this movie would not do the ramifications that they're claiming that it would, or else this could not apply. It, look, I know we're old guys talking about this in a
speak for yourself.
A 10-year-old kid in a theater doesn't care, much like Back to the Future, time travel just works. But somebody's too in the room is thinking too hard or not thinking enough.
Well, no kids cared about this one.
No, this is freaking this is the Matt LeBlanc Lost in Space thing with the younger Rob, with the Jared Harris character. Right down to the main like robot in that movie looks like all the Zerg robots. And speaking of which, talk about lazy writing. They only call him Zerg because they can't say Buzz.
I don't know how you get Zerg from Buzz.
I don't either.
How fucking stupid is this?
Yeah, I made that note too. I have no idea where you get that.
It's like Star Trek The Motion Picture. It's not V'ger, it's Voyager.
Oh, God. I literally just went through that.
And speaking of which, because I'm going to keep nerding out about Star Trek because we still haven't reviewed it yet. This plot is the ending finale of Star Trek Voyager, where it's an elderly Captain Janeway going back in time to stop her friends from dying. The difference is, at least here, that Voyager finale, which ironically is called Endgame, which makes it even funnier in hindsight, they don't recognize Janeway as the villain. In this, they at least acknowledge that what Buzz is doing is wrong, and I at least have to compliment them for addressing the cause and effect aspect of, by going back in time, you're essentially killing people who have adjusted and made lives. Because they actually talk about that before he kind of turns on them.
Mm-hmm. I like that they break this down. I like they take a moment to do it. I like this decision. There's no doubt what's going to happen, but I like this cause and effect of the reality of the situation they put themselves in. This is a good conflict.
Yeah, I just wish this didn't come so late into the movie because it doesn't really have enough time to breathe.
No. I don't need this movie longer, but I do think it could be paced separately. It seems like the opening happens really fast, the middle takes way too long, and then we cram the ending.
So he tells Buzz Prime that I need the fuel to travel further back into the past, but the main Buzz says that that would basically ruin everyone that established their lives, so he gets captured by, I'm going to call him Zerg in quotes, because he's not Zerg. Hashtag not my Zerg. But the... You know, they have to do the classic Star Wars thing of they go into the ship and just have to make it self-destruct. Because every ship in science fiction has a self-destruct button built in. I guess all of these were built by IKEA.
They are playing every fucking science fiction trope by this point. And I think in their mind, they find it to be homages. In my mind, I just find it to be derivative. At this point, I'm with you, Matt. I'm completely rebelling against this movie. I'm not going to say I was loving the first half of this, but I was having a better time than I was expecting. I was really getting involved in it. I was laughing a few times, not nearly as much as the worst Toy Story movies that we have discussed. But at this point, my head's spinning and I'm seeing one trope after another being thrown at me. And yeah, I'm rebelling as well.
Yeah, I'm going along with this ride and I'm like, this movie's not making me mad. I was just regretting that I had to sit down and watch this. When I sat down, I was like, thank God we're doing this because I can make these two guys watch the animated Hellboy movies when we get to that series. That's going to be my payback. As I get through this and I'm getting towards the end, I don't regret getting through this. I'm having a much better time than I ever could have possibly anticipated.
I don't think this is a terrible movie. I just think it's
misguided.
The biggest problem it has is it's tied to a vastly superior series.
Oh, God, yeah. And
no matter how much they try, you can't escape that as a trapping. Admiral Ackbar should have shown up in the animator's room yelling, it's a trap, don't make it. But what they do is they set the ship to self-destruct because the granddaughter has to do a leap of faith and go from one end of the ship to another because her big thing is she's terrified of space. And she sure gets over that pretty quick. But what they do is they make the ship self-destruct. Buzz goes to eject, and the explosion seemingly kills Zerg. And then they get back home and realize that they use the fuel to get out of there. So basically the movie amounted to nothing for all intents and purposes. And it's the whole thing of like, well, this is my home now. They get arrested, or so we think. But he says, you know, Buzz, you saved us from the robot empire. We're going to revive the Space Ranger Corps. And he selects all these dipshits instead of far more qualified people because they have moxie. We would all be dead if this was our reality.
Fort Marshal, this commander.
Are you breathing? Yes, you're hired.
Do you know you have to your ass? Yeah, exactly.
joining the military in the 90s. They did not care what we could do.
Well, speaking of not caring, Buzz gets a new fuel crystal, and they basically have now become the Enterprise, where they're going on a mission to investigate an unknown signal from uncharted space, which is one of the lines from the Toy Story toys when you press the button. So I thought that was a neat little way to end the movie on. But because it's a Disney-adjacent movie, we had a post-credits scene.
We do?
All the way at the end credits, where they show that Zurg survived.
Oh, they showed Zurg survived. Wait. I got a post-credit scene that was the commander sitting under the dome.
Yeah, so there's three of them. There's the commander. There's the droid finishing his directions, and there's Zurg's helmet lighting while he's drifting in space.
Wow, I saw one.
And I'm sure all of these will get payoffs very soon, because clearly the payoff was not in the box office returns, boys.
Can't wait for the sequel.
Well, speaking of which, does this warrant a sequel based on our overall enjoyment? On a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Lightyear? I'm going to flip a coin, and I'm going to go to Adam first.
Lightyear, the movie that nobody wanted, including Tim Allen, and they found a way to spend $200 million plus on this thing. I swear sometimes this is like the Silicon Valley technology companies just breaking something to see if they can. The most expensive direct-to-DVD movie, and they decided to put it in a theater. Oh, Disney, no wonder your stock hasn't changed in 8 years now. I didn't want to see this movie. I had no need to see this movie. The marketing told me there's no reason for me to care about this movie. However, this is a fun little time. It's amazing that it's only like an hour and 45 minutes, and it's still 5 to 10 minutes too long. But it's harmless. It's enjoyable enough. It is every possible trope that they could take of sci-fi movies and throw it in here is here. It doesn't work as good as little nods to the adults that are going to watch it because it's so overstuffed that it's not cute. It's just plagiarism to the point of almost insulting. But it's they're there. And because it happens so often, it takes the fun out of it. But the storyline, simple. The animation, gorgeous. When it focuses in on it, and a lot of those are close-up shots, looks absolutely spectacular. Chris Evans is fine, but he's not Tim Allen, and he's not supposed to be. I don't mind him, but he doesn't elevate whatsoever. Kiki Palmer, I think, does a pretty damn good job, and she's about it. You know, Taika Waititi is distracting. But this is one of those movies that it didn't need to happen, but it did. It's okay. It's enjoyable. When I could say, and I think all three of us are going to say the same thing, the best thing about this movie is an animatronic cat. You know, I guess I need a Sox popcorn bucket, but they didn't have it because this thing stuck around in theaters barely through the weekend. It's fine. If you're a completionist, thanks, Garrett, then go ahead and watch it. You won't be mad, but it's not going to make you feel like all the other Toy Story movies do and what every Pixar movie used to do. This is in the realm of Finding Dory and Monsters University and those type of cash grab sequels as opposed to a quality sequel. It's not bad. It's just not good. It's a six, and it's a strong six. You know, go ahead and see it. If you got kids that like Buzz, let them know that, hey, this is, you know, what the toy is based on, and they may have a good time as well. But for a movie that's not needed, it's just not bad.
It's not, it's Lightyear. It's not bad. Put that on a poster, yeah. Everybody. Sure, that would have caused people to go in droves to the movie, but Garrett, what about you? Are you going to go as high as a six?
Call this thing Bud Lightyear.
Adam has a lot of poster quality quotes on this thing. You know, the thing about this podcast that really made me want to do it, this podcast as a whole, is when we do franchises, when we do sequels, the big question I ask is, does the movie justify its existence? And so far, I think with every Toy Story movie that we've done in this retrospective, when we look at those movies, all of us at the time were like, you know what? This doesn't justify its existence. But then we saw the movie and we saw the themes that they were going for, and all of us pretty much resonated with, like I said earlier, with at least one of those films. In watching Lightyear, I asked myself, does it justify its existence? And the answer is no. However, I will say the biggest backhand compliment I'm going to say is this movie was not nearly as bad as I was expecting it to be, given its reputation. I think the first half of this movie, while it doesn't move at a clip, it's fun. And the introduction of Sox the Cat really injects life when it needed it. I love the relationship between Lightyear and Alicia. However, in watching that relationship develop, I thought, what was it about that relationship that drew Andy to it. And I can't see Andy watching that and saying, why don't I get an Alicia figure? Why don't I get this figure? Why don't I get a Socks the Cat figure? And that's where I think the justification of this movie falls on its face. I like Lightyear a little bit better than I was expecting, but that's still not much. I'm going lower than Adam. I'm giving this a 5, not a 4. It's a 5. There's enough enjoyment to get out of it. However, I can't see, Matt, you sitting one of your kids down and them lasting through this without them wanting to go through their phones or go find the next technology right next to them or go play a video game. This won't hold a kid's attention, I don't believe. But as a justification, it's a 5, nothing more.
Forget a kid's attention. This thing made me feel like I had ADHD. Which, I will say this, I don't think this is the worst movie Pixar has made, but I think it's far and away the most forgettable and arguably the most disposable, because, look, we live in a world where Cars 2 exists, and that's, even by the worst of Disney standards, that thing is almost unwatchable. And it doesn't have the, like, WTF mundanity of, like, The Good Dinosaur, where that thing at least could say it went through more hands than a McDonald's cheeseburger, but be that as it may, the word that I kept coming back to is uninspired. I think the ideas that are here, while they're nothing new we've seen, if you're any sort of science fiction enthusiast, you always can say, well, showing it to kids is the way to pass it down to the next generation. But what they're passing down is pretty half-baked. And I think there's every trope that's in here. You know, I could show my kids Flight of the Navigator or the best of Star Trek or even some of the worst of Star Trek and get more like of a high bar to make it accessible. And again, I think the issue is the fact that this has the Toy Story attachment, although they do their best to get around it. But if that was the case, then you should have just gotten rid of that damn opening crawl or reworked it to do something different. I think the casting in this is pretty beneath what I want from Pixar. That's not to say Chris Evans phoned it in. I just don't think he was right for this role. And I think this thing really needed a more confident hand to do something different and a little bit more of a gamble, because I think some of the recent Pixar movies like Hoppers and Turning Red show that you can take very simple stories and make them feel fresh, whether that's infusing them with a strong sense of culture or just being, in the case of Hoppers, being James Cameron's Avatar but actually good. How's that for a revelation? So my score is identical to Garrett. It's a 5, but I think that's also a bit of damnation, because I can't shrug a hatred for it, and I also can't endorse it. It's the definition of that Bart Simpson gif of meh, and I don't feel like that's an exaggeration. So it's a 5 on 10 for me. But speaking of 5, boys.
Oh, boy.
The toys are back again in Toy Story 5, which should be subtitled based on the trailers, Toys versus Tech. We've had 7 years since the 4th one. And I got to tell you, this conceit of the iPad dominating this kid's life, I think is an ingenious way to bring the toys back into relevancy. What do you guys think?
At the time we were recording this, me and Jen had just seen The Mandalorian and Grogu, which is a review that's probably up by the time you listen to this. The trailer for Toy Story 5 played before Mandalorian and Grogu. Before that trailer, Jen was not wanting to go with me to Toy Story 5. After that trailer, she looked at me, she said, "That's cute, I'm going." I don't want to say I'm inspired. I'm feeling the same exact way I felt before Toy Story 4. I thought Toy Story 3 closed that book hard, and Toy Story 4 picked it up and kind of made their own thing with it. And my review reflected that it was not the best of the series, even though it was much better than I expected. This, I'm not going to say it looks uninspired, but the thing of technology taking over a kid's life, we've seen that. I'm not sure how I'm feeling going into next week's film. However, I am looking forward to going with my fiance, who is pretty enthusiastic. So I am right on that fence.
Adam, are you going to hop on the other side?
I don't care. I really want to. And what's amazing is nobody in my house cares. I got kids who grew up with the other ones, and they're just like, no, you go see it. I was like, oh, come on. But then again, I thought about it. You know, my oldest is 18, which means she was 11 when Toy Story 4 came out. That's a long time, you know, and Toy Story 3 even long. I mean, these time jump, you know, who do you think is going to keep coming around? Because to have a fifth movie, you're just hoping that there's some nostalgia. Watch the trailer. I get it. You know what? I had this discussion, but also a ThinkPad. a Lenovo ThinkPad, you're already 8 years in the past. I don't even know if those things are around anymore. You know, so I don't know. But then again, every time I say that, except for Lightyear, they surprise me. So maybe this will do a little more than I thought. I don't know how the gang is getting back together, so that'll be interesting to see. But they are and will be there because, you know, you got a friend in us. Yeah. So even though I may not have a friend in these two guys for making me use one of my A-list credits to go see Toy Story 5.
Yeah, they have a friend in us. It's called our wallets. We keep shelling out the money every time.
Yeah, we can't write these off.
No, and my defense of Garrett is that every time we come in arms crossed, these movies will pull something out. So
yeah,
if this breaks the streak, then you have every right to be like, "I told you so." But
I will say, though,
if that attitude, like, we're on Fool Me Fifes.
I just got back from a couple days at Disneyland in California, which of course is Disneyland, and California Adventures got Pixar Pier. They got the Toy Story, you know, Midway Mania and all that. There was nothing promoting this movie, which I found shocking.
Wow, that is shocking.
Because you would think there would already at least be some stuff promoting Toy Story 5, but there really wasn't. And I don't think that necessarily means much because, you know, they just had a whole lot of upheaval with the company. But I was just shocked that there was not in the parades, not in the posters, not in the merchandise, nothing. So, but we'll see. It's coming quick. I mean, we start to really get into the summer season and we are full steam ahead. Yeah. It's taken a while, and there is now something every other week.
Uh-huh. Yeah, me and Jen were looking at the calendar. It's like, oh, Disclosure Day, that day. Oh, there's He-Man this week. Oh, even, like, the week after is Toy Story 5. Oh, look, we have the Odyssey. Like, every week there's something, and we're covering Supergirl, all of
He-Man.
Them.
Yeah. Oof.
For the record, there was advertising for it. Toy Story 5 at California Adventure. You just walk by the booth where Randy Newman had a tin cup at a piano going, "Please go see Toy Story 5.
That poor bastard's taking a beating on this podcast.
So is Matt's ears every time he's got to hear the songs.
Well, until next week when we review the newest installment, Toy Story 5, Mission Log, It's a Secret Podcast in Uncharted Space. Let's go. Thank you, boys.
I'm going to have some words with this lily pad and let her know how things are run around here.
Try to stay calm, Jesse.
Buzz, you know me. I'm the definition of calm.
That's not going to work.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Good job, troops.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Let's go home.
I'm glad I got to see you again.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as Star Wars, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, Indiana Jones, Masters of the Universe, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Incredibles films, and so much more.
I don't believe that man's ever been to medical school.
Listening. I'm always listening.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Ah, that went well. It's good to see them fighting again.
It sure is.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You have saved our lives. We are eternally grateful.
Huh?
Come on, I'm not lying down on the job.
A Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, and Dave.
You would not believe what I've been through tonight.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You got a lot to look forward to, folks.
Scheduling done by Matt.
My hero!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Potato Head, Mr. and Mrs.
Here.
Trickus, check.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
You still worried?
About Andy? Nah, it'll be fun while it lasts.
I'm proud of you, cowboy.
Besides, when it all ends, I'll have old Buzz Lightyear to keep me company. For infinity and beyond.
And it was odd because Pixar, some of their best work was around this time. Inside Out, Coco, purely original movies. And before all you people start saying, oh my God, they just ripped off Herman's head, I'm going to bitch slap you when you talk about Inside Out. But that notwithstanding, we got Toy Story 4. And around that time was when Tim Allen was talking about, yeah, they're probably going to do a spinoff film and I'm game to do it. But that, as we'll talk about, did not wind up coming. He didn't show up to the recording booth.
People were saying that Inside Out was a ripoff of Herman's Head. I've never heard that.
Oh, yeah. There was a small niche in the same way that people bitch about like Star Wars ripping another established science fiction trope off. It was the same thing. Nowhere near that degree. But I read a couple reviews. That was like their only criticism of it. And I just couldn't.
That is so fucking funny.
That by that case, you could have said they ripped off the Eddie Murphy movie Meet Dave.
Yeah.
I didn't think I signed my name to those reviews, but I guess I did. Sorry, I'm one of only six people that remember Herman's Head, and Garrett's one of them.
I am too. Yeah, I love that show.
And they said, but he takes off the mask, and it's an older Buzz Lightyear, voiced by James Brolin. And my question was why?
Because Chris Evans killed his son in...
No, he didn't. Technically, Tony Stark did.
Okay, well, and this was an apology for that? I don't know. Like, this was a bit of a what the fuck casting.
This plot is the ending finale of Star Trek Voyager, where it's an elderly Captain Janeway going back in time to stop her friends from dying. The difference is, at least here, that Voyager finale, which ironically is called Endgame, which makes it even funnier in hindsight, they don't recognize Janeway as the villain. In this, they at least acknowledge that what Buzz is doing is wrong. And I at least have to compliment them for addressing the cause and effect aspect of, by going back in time, you're essentially killing people who have adjusted and made lives. Because they actually talk about that before he kind of turns on him.
Mm-hmm. I like that we get that. And one, I just got to say, for anybody that hasn't, Voyager, great freaking show.
That finale second, sucks, though.
Yeah, but second best Star Wars live-action TV series. But I,
you mean
I
Star like, Trek?
What did I say? Did I say Star Wars?
You did.
Yeah, you oh. Just... Now go say five Hail Marys.
Oh, jeez. Timbly Wimbly. All right, Doctor Who. But I...
Hi, toys! Hi, toys!